Hello, and welcome to our latest dispute resolution webinar. And today I'm joined by Neil Merchandani, a guru from Hogan Lovells, and we are looking at the intricacies of alternative dispute resolution. Now, I know it's been around for a long time. I can remember, God help me, that the Law Society published a paper about ADR back in 1989. And at the time, I think people frankly sniggered and thought it was all a bit of a joke. But my God, the world has changed, as we will see. And there is now, I think, an irresistible pressure pushing the parties in the direction of ADR. On our agenda today, we're going to look at the various forms of ADR, the nature of mediation, the skills of the mediator, the timing of mediation. And I'm going to look at the end about the very recent, and we can date this back to August last year, I think, the push towards compulsory mediation. So plenty to talk about. And with that, I pass over now to Neil, and he's going to, I think, get us underway with a guide, first of all, to the various forms of ADR, remembering that mediation, which is always mentioned, is but one form of ADR. It is one chapter in the book of ADR. But Neil will tell you all. Neil.
Thanks, Dominic. Just a reminder for you about the forms of ADR, as Dominic mentioned. ADR and mediation are often used interchangeably, but of course, as many of you will know, there are different forms of ADR, albeit that mediation is probably the best known form. So if we look at the slide on forms of ADR, this is just a reminder for you. There are five forms of ADR that I've mentioned in these slides. The first one, probably the one best known to all of you, will be mediation. All of these forms of ADR generally involve a neutral third party. And key to ADR is that that third party is not a decision maker. And that is one of the strengths of ADR in my view and in my experience. So looking at the forms, first one, mediation, a neutral third party, often appointed by the parties, normally appointed by the parties, assists the parties to reach a negotiated agreement. And many of you will be familiar with mediators, perhaps, that you've worked with over a period of years. They all have different skills, it's very common to use the same mediator more than once, particularly if one's had a good experience with them.
Of course.
Second form of ADR, less common, but one which is, I think, growing in prominence, is early neutral evaluation. And this is where a neutral third party, sometimes a judge, often a judge, appointed by the parties or indeed at the judge's own motion, provides a non-binding opinion on the facts of the case.
I'm going to be looking at the Lomax and the 2020 guidance now in the Queen's Bench Division on E&E. So I will deal with that later in detail. Yes,
absolutely. And the early neutral evaluation is intended to look at the legal merits of a case, a non-binding opinion. And this is something where I think we've seen increased judicial interest in this, as Dominic's going to go into in some detail later. A third form of ADR is expert determination. And here an independent expert, normally from the field of the dispute, appointed by the parties, provides a decision which is usually binding. In this process, the rules of evidence, rules of natural justice and the strict rules of evidence don't normally apply. And there is limited ability to enforce a decision, but there is also limited ability to appeal a decision. And we see expert determinations often in corporate transactions where, for example, there may be accounting disputes and an expert accountant may be appointed by the parties or in absence of agreement appointed by, for example, the Institute of Chartered Accountants. So, again, that's a perhaps less common form of ADR, but a very important one, particularly in the corporate context.
Excellent.
Another form of ADR, moving on, is MedArb. Now, this is, in my experience at least, a very unusual process. I have not come across a situation in which we have worked on a MedArb appointment. The process itself, in a sense, it almost does what it says on the tin. The process starts as a mediation, but if no settlement is reached, the mediator then becomes an arbitrator who can impose a binding decision. And I think this dual function for the mediator stroke arbitrator is one of the reasons that it's a very tricky process to get right or to find the right case for this. One of the advantages of a mediator not being able to impose a decision is that both sides may be able to speak freely to the mediator in confidence and tell them what they're really thinking, for example. But if you know that the mediator, in the absence of a settlement, then becomes an arbitrator, that limits the way in which you might communicate with the particular mediator. So mm-hmm. certainly in my experience, we haven't seen great uptake in relation to MedArb.
And Neil, may I just suggest that somebody who's a good mediator may not necessarily be a good arbitrator.
No, that's absolutely right, Dominic. What the features, and I'll come on to this a little bit later, the features you look for in a mediator may not be the same features you look for in an arbitrator. I think with an arbitrator, given that you are entrusting that person with making the decision, ultimately, mm-hmm. that is not necessarily a skill set which a mediator has to have, because they as a mediator, they need to be looking for perhaps common ground or creative solutions. And an arbitrator just doesn't have that role. And I think I think to switch between the two mindsets is very difficult. And I think it would be interesting to actually get some mediators' perspectives on that as regards how often they've done it and whether they think the mindset is hard to manage. The difference in mindset is hard to manage. The final form of ADR we mention is adjudication. And I think this is most commonly used in construction disputes. And again, it's actually a very interesting form of ADR process. It recognises that on a long running project like a construction project, there will inevitably be disputes that arise. And it provides a pragmatic way of resolving those disputes on an interim basis within a set time limit, which allows the project to move on. I think in that respect, it's a very sophisticated process. Mm-hmm. And an interesting one. I'm not a construction litigator, but I've come across disputes where the project lasts for the project runs for maybe 5 to 10 years, and the disputes run for 10 to 20 years. again, in adjudication means that the process doesn't simply stop, and a building remains completely unbuilt while people are arguing. Right. So, in adjudication, the decision is immediately binding, but on an interim basis, and it's enforceable. But the overall dispute may subsequently be referred to litigation or arbitration. And again, as I mentioned, you know, this sort of protects cash flow. You pay now, argue later, and allows both parties, who presumably are still involved in the project and want to be involved in the project, to carry on with that, even though they have, as it were, sidebar arguments.
Sure. Okay. Right, you're now going to look at how your experience or your firm's experience of ADR pans out.
Our firm's, the Hogan Lovells experience of ADR, I do an awful lot of mediations within our London office, and we did a survey over a 3-year period of mediations that we conducted. And it was very interesting. We wanted to get a feel for, firstly, how many mediations we were conducting within the practice, and then what was people's experience of it? Did they enjoy the process? Did they think it was valuable? Did clients like it? Was it successful in resolving disputes? And it was very interesting what the survey showed. I mean, it wasn't a scientific survey, but it was based on experience of users, of lawyers who'd been through sometimes small and sometimes very large mediation processes. So the survey itself, as I say, covered a 3-year period, and the results were really quite startling, I think, for me. 77% of the mediations that we engaged in resulted in a settlement on the day or very shortly afterwards. 70% of the participants in our survey reported a completely positive experience of mediation. Now, that's not, in fact, the breakdown of the other numbers was that 20% were neutral or had a mixed view of it. Only 10% had a negative view of the process, which basically shows that effectively 90% of those surveyed find it either completely positive or had a mixed view of it, only 10% completely negative. And again, that was actually a surprisingly clear outcome, I think.
That's a remarkable stat.
The value of the claims ranged from as low as double-digit thousands to billions of dollars. And a process that allows you to satisfactorily resolve disputes in that range is clearly one worth considering. Many of our clients are very sophisticated litigators themselves, in-house litigators, or very sophisticated general counsel. They know the benefits that mediation can bring. And clearly, one of the features of some of the mediations I've been involved in, not all of them, but some of them, is that we've been able to reach creative solutions and not simply resolve the dispute that is the subject of litigation, but actually, in the context of an ongoing commercial relationship, we've been able to identify points further down the road where there might be disputes and resolve those.
So head them off before they arise.
Absolutely. But both sides perhaps have anticipated a problem. It's not the subject of litigation, which they're both, I think, pleased about. But if you can resolve it in the context of the mediation, then that's a win-win again for both sides. And mediators have a unique ability to do that. A judge does not have the ability to do that. An expert does not have the ability to do that. And clearly a mediator arbitrator doesn't really have the ability to do that. And I think that's one of the unique benefits of mediation. Moving on to what makes a good mediator, in my experience at least, there's a balance, I think, to be struck in when you appoint a mediator between whether you want a mediator with a good technical understanding of the dispute. For example, it may be a very complicated pharmaceutical dispute involving understanding of chemistry, or in areas of intellectual property, or maybe in construction, or indeed in a financial instrument, as against the general ability to mediate. Many of the most successful mediators can do both. They don't necessarily have to have the technical experience, but they have enough of an understanding of perhaps the industry or certainly the litigation process to understand the benefits of mediation. Many people wondered whether judges themselves, perhaps who retired from the bench, would ultimately make good mediators. Quite a few judges went into that area in the early days of mediation, including some of the most senior judges, the equivalent of Supreme Court judges. And there were undoubtedly reservations as to whether some of those judges had the mindset to make good mediators. But in my experience, they did. They understood that what was required of them was different to simply rendering a decision. And they grasped that very quickly. And they also brought to the process a gravitas and a respect which was beneficial to both sides in a mediation process. And this was at a time when mediation was very new in the UK. It had developed more in the United States. And we transported it from the US over here, including with some very accomplished US mediators. So I think I have an open mind in relation to judges as good mediators. The experience has been that they do make good mediators. Similarly, lawyers, some people prefer a non-lawyer to be a mediator. But again, I think it's all about the skill set of the particular individual. Sure. And that's one of the reasons that if you find a mediator who you engage with and you like and who does a good job for you, you tend to stick with them regardless of whether whether they're technical experts. In terms of other skills that I think a mediator needs, they need to be able to listen well. They have patience, have flexibility, be willing to think creatively, and they may posit some ideas which both sides disagree with or whatever, but they get the parties thinking. They have to be non-judgmental. It may be particularly for experienced lawyers, whether they're lawyers or judges, it must be a natural mindset for them to say, well, look, actually, your case really isn't very good. and I think you should take whatever deal you can get. They have to avoid doing that because that is a very quick way to lose confidence in the process.
That's the way they sort of betray the sense of a mediation, don't they, which is to be truly independent and not judgmental.
Yes, and I think that's particularly the case where one side really does have a weak case, but perhaps they don't appreciate that, or they haven't. Their lawyers are invested somehow in the case, and therefore there are other tensions within that relationship. Or frankly, a case has been issued, and 6 months after it's been issued, another case comes out with a judgment which actually affects the merits completely of the case.
Of course,
you know that can happen, and it can take a client some getting used to. Indeed. So I think the non-judgmental aspect of a mediator is very important. And a final thing is stamina. I think for most people, and many of you will have experienced this, if you give a mediation a day, it will take a day. If you give it 5 days, it will take 5 days. And that is one of my frustrations with the process, in the sense that if a party says 3 days for something, then chances are not much will happen until perhaps the second half of the second day.
Sure.
The clock ticking is a very powerful reminder to clients that they need to grasp the nettle, and indeed to their lawyers. So I think stamina is important.
Can I just pick up on your point there, Neil? Only the legendary, the head of claims at the Ministry of Defence, Jeff Mitchell, fabulous man, he said to me, he said his golden rule, and he was dealing with sometimes multi-million pound mediations, was that you set a finish time, no ifs, no buts, you finish then, because otherwise it can just ramble on. And as you so rightly say, knowing that there is a deadline, knowing that there is a cut-off point, it does focus the mind wonderfully.
I think that's absolutely spot on, Dominic. I've come across instances where the mediator himself or herself has said, I have to be finished by 6 o'clock, or I have to be finished by 8 o'clock. I can't stay any later than that. And again, that gets everyone adjusted to the timetable of when progress needs to be made. Yeah. But you also have some really fascinating differences in approach between mediators. And so, for example, I mediated with one very eminent mediator a few years ago, and we went to see him with the other side before the mediation to have an introductory discussion. And he basically said, this is how I mediate. And if you don't like it, you can hit the road. And what he said, and again, this illustrates completely, you know, big differences in approach. He said, I insist that the parties have lunch and dinner with each other during the mediation.
Wow. Now that's interesting.
And of course, when we were told this, everyone shifted uncomfortably in their seat. This was in the introductory session. But he said, no, I, if you don't like it, you can find somebody else. But both clients accepted it in the end. They didn't argue too much. And it was very interesting because, you know, we did have lunch together in a plenary room, and we had dinner together as well. And the mediation was one day mediation. But it did run late into the evening. And this is where the stamina issue came in. But it was very interesting because for the dinner, he sat the two principal clients next to each other. And knowing that they would talk and that they would talk socially to some extent. And there was a rapport building. And again, you know, notwithstanding reservations about this at the beginning of his introduction to this, it was a very powerful thing to do. And it worked. We didn't settle on the day, but we settled within a day or two after that. But having said that, I've also had mediations where the two sides could not bear to be in the same room as each other. So we didn't have a plenary session. I've also had mediations where, you know, on a 3 day mediation, the other side didn't show up for the third day. Needless to say, you know, it's quite hard to make much progress in that.
That's bad form.
But it's interesting because they were cases which were very difficult, and there were reasons. It wasn't simply the question of the merits. There were reasons, for example, enforcement reasons that affected this, and so one understood what in the end those mediations failed, and there was good reason for that. And one moved on with the litigation. The mediation itself was still productive. It was good to see the whites of people's eyes, and it was good for both sides to have the opportunity to, as it were, beat each other up on the merits of their cases. But you won't always succeed. I mean, and I'm sure people, and that's no fault of the mediator. It's no fault necessarily of the parties, or at least one of the parties, perhaps. Other issues that I've experienced have been ones where, you know, a key factor at the beginning of a mediation is have both sides got full authority to settle?
Yes.
And I've come across instances that this is something that we often pay a lot of attention to in the run up to a mediation. And what one I have heard of a situation in which the two principal clients shook hands on a deal. And both sides left their room where they were with the mediator, very happy with the outcome. Unfortunately, one of the parties then reported back to their CEO, and the CEO said, "I'm not doing that deal." And so that generated a lot of heat and light about the question of authority. There's only so much one can do about that in advance of a mediation, but again, a skilled mediator will try and tease out if there are any wrinkles in authority and try and neutralize them before you have a sort of heat and light moment, as right. I just mentioned. Right. We've talked about mediators, but I think it's useful now as well to move on to the court's attitude to ADR and indeed mediation. This is one of those areas, and Dominic will also deal with this in a bit more detail later. It's one of those areas where the court's understanding and knowledge of the process has really grown over the last 10 to 15 years, maybe even 20 years or so. And there's been a growing acceptance with members of the bench of the benefits of mediation, the benefits of ADR generally, but particularly mediation. And one can see that the court's attitude to ADR has changed as a result of that.
Can I make one observation before you continue with this? It's a very simple point, but it sounds bizarre, but judges don't want to judge. I think we've now got to the point where judges, they want people to settle. They want them to go away. You think about Part 36, which is another mechanism to get people to settle. And I think never lose sight of that fact. Back to you, Neil. Sorry.
Yes. Dominic. Sorry, there was a bang at my end, so I don't know whether that last bit you will have been picked up. Hopefully not. Judges. There is a balance to be struck here between judges wanting parties to settle their disputes, and actually the English courts being well regarded throughout the world as appropriate forum. To resolve very difficult disputes, and to do so with the benefit of superbly experienced judges, a very rigorous process to get to a judgment involving both sides, but giving full disclosure and issues like that. So there is a balance to be struck between, as it were, forcing parties mm-hmm. to settle and encouraging it.
Yes.
I think this is one where perhaps in years previously, the courts were very reluctant to force parties to settle. I think they still are reluctant to do that, but they are much more robust now about indicating to parties the benefits of exploring the mediation process.
Yeah.
And if a party, as I think we'll come on to later, if a party unreasonably refuses to engage in that process, then they will be punished by the court. Most likely through costs, and there is significant case law about that, which we'll come on to. In relation to the actual CPR rules themselves, we have the pre-action practice direction, which indicates that before commencing proceedings, the court expects the parties to have exchanged information, sufficient information to consider whether a form of ADR might be appropriate to assist with settlement. And obviously the pre-action practice direction has set out an awful lot of detail about what a claimant party needs to do before they can initiate a formal litigation process. The overriding objective, again, CPR 1.4 requires active case management by the court, which includes encouraging the parties to use or to consider ADR. And we often see requests for a stay for ADR under CPR 26.4. A party can request in its directions questionnaire a stay of the proceedings to allow an ADR process to take place. Again, this is quite early on in the process of a case, and it shows the English court wanting the parties to consider the opportunity for settlement and the opportunity for ADR at every stage of the action, whether it be pre-action, which in my experience is pretty rare, or post-action, but let's say after pleadings have closed, or after disclosure has been given, or after witness statements, depending on what's appropriate and what's felt appropriate by each of the sides, and indeed by the judge in giving directions at, for example, a case management conference. In relation to costs, we've touched on the way in which the court can exercise its disapproval, if you like, of parties unreasonably refusing to mediate or not giving mediation due consideration. The court has a wide discretion in relation to costs, and judges have certainly shown themselves much more prepared to exercise that discretion and to see if a party who's refused to mediate, but for no good reason, or for what turn out not to be good reasons, then that party can expect, even if they're the successful party, they can expect to be penalised in costs either at the end of the case or in a detailed assessment.
Sure.
The court guides, for example, the commercial court guide encourages parties to consider ADR. And again, case questions on the case management information sheet relate to ADR. And then in relation to case law, there is a growing body of case law on unreasonable refusals to mediate, where judges in relation to successful parties say, well, actually, yes, you've won your case, but you didn't mediate, you didn't give good reasons for not doing so, and therefore I'm going to disallow some of the costs. And again, a very powerful way of reminding litigating parties that just because they win their case does not necessarily mean they shouldn't have tried in mediation to settle. One of the issues there is that mediation is a process completely within the control of each party. You go into the mediation, even if you don't think a settlement is possible, a good mediator can drive a settlement or find common ground sufficient to allow the sides to reach a deal. And that will, depending on how early that is in the process, that may make a huge saving in costs, a huge saving in management time given over to litigation. And obviously, the earlier in the process mediation happens, the greater the saving of legal costs. And what we find is that the tricky thing is actually what's the appropriate time to have a mediation. As I say, is it after close of pleadings? Is it after witness statements? Is it after disclosure? The problem with the later it is in the process, obviously, the more legal costs have been incurred. But also that shows clients that, you know, this is an expensive process. To do it as well as the English courts expect it to be done, it is expensive. You do need to deal with disclosure. You do need to deal with witness statements, although I think certainly that's an expensive part of the process, and a mediation that takes place after disclosure, perhaps, but pre-witness statements, it perhaps generates the biggest savings relation to litigation costs. The other advantage in relation to this is that it gets the key decision maker who is ultimately going to sign off on any deal involved in the process. The unreasonable refusal to mediate case law is a very salutary reminder to practitioners that just because their client is very gung-ho about going to court and they want to have their day in court, they may have their day in court, they may win in court, but they may not get all their costs back. And that's actually a bit of
a victory, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a bit of a sucker punch if you've won your decision and you expect to get you know, 50 to 60, if not higher, percent of your costs back from the other side, if you find that that is actually being reduced because of this criticism, then that's an unfortunate end to what is actually a winning case. In relation to other case law as well, if there's a contractual agreement to engage in ADR, and many many sophisticated corporates do have a process built in into their dispute resolution procedure provisions, again the court will normally enforce that. You would be expected to engage in ADR if it's contractually provided, and proceedings may well be stayed to allow that to take place. We've touched on the court rules, but perhaps we should also move on to the court's approach to mediation issues. And I think there are two key aspects of the mediation process which which are illustrated here. One is the confidentiality in the process, and then the without prejudice nature of the process, the without prejudice privilege that applies. They go hand in hand in a mediation, and quite often mediations are set up on a confidential and without prejudice basis very explicitly. Certainly in my experience, that normally is made express, and if it isn't made express in the relevant contract or whatever, then we do so in correspondence. If there is an express term for confidentiality, that's ideal. That is the best scenario to be in. But even if there isn't an express term, the court will usually imply confidentiality in relation to a mediation process. And again, I think one of the main reasons for that is that the court wants to encourage this. If you go into a negotiation knowing that the other side can simply take any points that you have conceded or an admission that you might have made as not confidential and refer that to the court, then that really would skewer the utility of the mediation process. So confidentiality is absolutely key in this, and it will normally prevail. The pharmacist decision is a very interesting, albeit perhaps unusual, example of a situation in which the court overrode confidentiality in the process on the basis that it considered it was in the interests of justice to do so. And confidentiality is part of a mediation process which applies to both the parties involved, or all the parties involved in the mediation, but it also applies to the mediator. So the mediator has an expectation of confidentiality in relation to their participation, his or her participation in the process. But as I say, pharmacist is well worth looking at in that regard, because it shows a situation where the mediator was ordered to give evidence to the court about what happened in the mediation. And that was because, not because the dispute was about what the mediation decided in that particular case. It was actually a question about whether the mediation agreement was entered into under economic duress. So it's a very unusual example. I've never come across a situation in my caseload where we've had to go to the court in relation to such an issue. But clearly, it was a decision which has given some very helpful guidance about the extent of confidentiality in relation to the mediation process. It also gave guidance in relation to the without prejudice privilege applicable to the process. So without prejudice privilege applies to the parties, but the mediator does not have without prejudice privilege applicable to him or her. So the parties can waive the without prejudice privilege if they choose to do so, but the mediator does not have any role in that process. And again, pharmacist is authority or indication of that. One of the aspects about looking into these issues from the court's perspective is it is, in my experience, very reluctant to open up the Pandora's box of what actually happened in a mediation. And both sides, I think, certainly I look very askance, if you like, at and the other side trying to bring in to correspondence or to any documents put before the court what actually happened in a mediation. And one needs to be very careful about that. It's a slippery slope if you do so. So, for example, you know, if you say in open correspondence, for example, that, you know, the other side unreasonably refused to mediate, that may itself be covered by WP privilege. The fact that they refused to mediate may be covered by without prejudice privilege and therefore may not be allowed to be put in front of the judge. And, you know, there have been cases where judges have restricted what can be said about a failed mediation or a refusal to enter into mediation. Again, I think the English court has a sensible approach to this, which is that I think they understand, judges understand, that if you start lifting up the tiles of this process, you may lift up one tile, but where do you stop? And that's very dangerous for the process. It would probably have a really damaging effect on confidence in the mediation, confidence in the whole process being confidential as well as without prejudice.
Yes, and it would stop people perhaps being frank and open with the process if they think that something they say behind closed doors is actually going to be flung into the public arena.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, concessions that you may make in a plenary session, not necessarily a concession, but just an acceptance that some points are stronger than others.
Yeah. Oiling the wheels. Trying to be constructive.
A cynical party may take that acceptance and put it in their back pocket and then try and use it at a later stage. And really that's inappropriate. If I think that's happening in a mediation I'm involved with, we put a stop to it very quickly. You know, we may talk to the mediator and say, look, you know, we're trying to do this in good faith. You know, the fact that you may say, the fact that we may have dropped points 1, 3, and 7 does not mean we think they're bad, but we're not prioritizing them.
Sure.
And again, if somebody comes out of that saying, oh, that's great, you've dropped 1, 3, and 7, you clearly don't think they've got any merit or whatever, and say, well, for these purposes, we're prepared to deprioritize those ones because our main concerns are points 2, 4, and 6 or whatever. You know, that's fine and that works in the process. But it's a tricky balance, because if you think the other side are engaging in an approach like that, then that necessarily constrains what you say to them. And what will then happen is that you probably speak more to the mediator on the basis that the mediator cannot convey what you say to the other side without your permission. And again, that's another area where confidence in the mediator is paramount. You need to be able to trust their integrity. And in my experience, mediators, you know, are very good about this. They're very rigorous about what they can and cannot say to the other side with your permission. But if you feel the other side are messing you around in this or they're not engaging in the process in good faith, then that limits how far you will be prepared to be frank with them about certain aspects. And indeed, if in the mediation process you then put the two principles together, the mediator puts the two principles together without lawyers, perhaps, on the basis that they just need that final push to get over the line, then again, we as advisors to that principle would have to say, look, you need to be careful here, because they are, if you don't do a deal and if they see that you have effectively accepted that point 7 is rubbish, then they're going to do certain things after the mediation to push on that. Maybe they'll apply to strike that point out or whatever. And again, you know, you need good faith on both sides with the process, and you need to have confidence in what the other side are doing and what they are saying and how they're saying it and what they're saying to their clients. And again, I think a skillful mediator picks up on that very quickly. If they think one side is messing around or is not acting in good faith, then they will push that side. As far as I can see, they'll make it clear to them that they expect them to be engaging in this process properly.
Sure. Right. Okay. I'm going to say a bit about this vexed and really hot topic of should ADR be made compulsory. A number of authorities, if I deal with it chronologically, back in 2004, the Court of Appeal in a case called Halsey said that it was improper for the court to order ADR. And the reasoning was that the Court of Appeal said, well, to order ADR would be to breach Article 6, which, think about it, is a nonsense. Saying to the parties, go away, pause, you know, try and sort this out between you, that is not an insurmountable obstacle to going to trial. And indeed,
I always found that decision a tough one to understand, because for the reasons you've given. I mean, the ADR process is completely voluntary. It works because it's voluntary, and interestingly, that was 2004 for Halsey, and Halsey obviously was a very important decision. But a couple of years earlier, there was a case that which you may recall, the Dunnerton Rail Track case.
Yes,
which was perhaps the first case I recall reading about mediation, and that was one where the court held that a party who refused to consider whether a case is suitable for mediation would be at risk on costs. Yes. So it was, I mean, perhaps we've moved back to the more in line with Dunnett than where Halsey was.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think one of the points in Dunnett, as I recall, is that in the end, the claimant said, well, actually, I'd have taken an apology, but because there was no conversation, the defendant didn't know that. And so the matter rambled on to trial. So quite right. Now, so Halsey said no, but then Lomax in August last year has opened the door indirectly to reconsideration of this point. Lomax was the court appeal decision which said that the court can order parties to engage in something Neil described earlier, and that is early neutral evaluation. That's where a judge expresses an opinion about the apparent merits of the case. Now, in Lomax, first instance, High Court judge, she said, well, I can't do it without the consent of the parties. Court appeal said, it's a power of the court. It's the court, up to the court, not up to the parties. And so the court appeal said, power is there to order early neutral evaluation. The Civil Procedure Rules Committee meeting last autumn after that picked up on this and said, well, hold on a bit. If you can order E&E, which we can, why on earth can't we order alternative dispute resolution? And he's back on the agenda. Indeed, if you look in the introduction to the new white book, page 13, Sir Geoffrey Voss actually says the time has come to reconsider the Halsey principles. So there is real movement out there. Keep an eye on this. But it is absolutely something that I think we're going to see more on. And we are heading, I think, inexorably towards the courts grasping the nettle and saying, we tell you, you are to go away and engage in ADR.
On this particular point, sorry, I don't want to interrupt your flow there.
No, you're not. It's great to talk.
But I actually think Lomax is an incredibly significant decision, actually, beyond the impact of ADR. If anything, it's even more significant. The reason for this being that, as a practitioner, if the court orders me to engage in ADR, I have no problem with that. You know, even if I have a client who's reluctant to do so, I would be absolutely comfortable that I could say to them, look, you know, this process is neutral. It's non-binding. You know, we can select a good mediator. My experience has been overwhelmingly positive about mediation. So I would have no problem if the court ordered me to mediate in that sense. But if the court ordered my client to engage in an early neutral evaluation, that's a really significant, that's a further significant step. The reason being that you're talking now about a judge, possibly the judge who's made the order, deciding, giving a as it were, a draft judgment on what they think the merits of the case are and how it's going to go. Now, that is well beyond, in my view, an order for ADR. It also has a potentially significant impact on the case if it runs on past the E&E. namely that the judge who, if it's the case handling judge who does the early neutral evaluation, they can no longer participate in the case. And so you move on to a new judge. Now, of course, you know, if you've got a long running case of maybe 4 or 5 years, let's say, and you've had an assigned judge who knows the ins and outs of the case and how it's developed, and then there's an order for EME, and that judge makes the early neutral evaluation and then has to drop out of the case, then need a new judge to read in and get up to speed, and that could actually be quite difficult costs. And also, one of the interesting things about this, which you have with E&E, which you don't have with ADR, is almost a tactical issue. If one side feels that the judge is not with them for whatever reason, they may try and be cynical and actually encourage that judge to do the E&E on the basis that they get the judge out. Now, I have no experience of that, and E&E, in my experience, is pretty rare. But that's why I think this is even more significant than simply an ADR order.
Yes. Well, excellent stuff. Now, if I move on to my next slide, just for those who are looking at E&E, and it's been rare so far, but now the Court of Appeal has said we're up for it, I think the tide is turning. Do have a look at a case called Telecom Centre and Sanderson, where Master McLeod has produced a draft directions order for E&E. So have a look at that. My final point for we come back to a few thoughts from Neil, is the developments on costs. And we've had three cases this year so far on this. In DSN, the defendant said, "We're not prepared to engage in ADR. We've got a cast iron defence." They lost. The judge said, the High Court judge, "No defence, however strong, by itself justifies a failure to engage in any kind of ADR." And I flag that up because if you go back to Halsey 2004, I mean, the crux of that case was that the Court of Appeal said that a defendant who thought they had a good defence was entitled to say, "I'm not going to engage in ADR." That is now history. Be warned. In BXB, even further, again, High Court, the defendant refused to engage and failed to put in a witness statement explaining why they had not taken part in ADR. So the judge said, "Right, indemnity costs are awarded against you." And then in a case called Wales, we see one of the defendants refusing to engage in ADR, and they lost half of their costs for part of the action. So it is deadly serious. If ever somebody mentions ADR, it is your legal duty to respond constructively to that proposal. That doesn't mean that you engage in ADR forthwith, but the last thing you do is ignore that suggestion. I think Neil's now going to take us out of this with some thoughts on where we're going next on ADR.
Thanks, Dominic. Yes, I think the final slide is looking at the future, and we've highlighted two aspects of mediation. One is the Singapore Mediation Convention, or to give it its full name, the United Nations Convention on International Settlement Agreements resulting from mediation. And this gives parties who've reached a settlement through mediation a mechanism to enforce the terms of that agreement in other jurisdictions in a similar way to what the New York Convention does in connection with arbitration awards, which is very extensive and a very powerful supporter for arbitration awards and their enforcement. The Singapore Convention enters into force on the 12th of September this year. It was signed by I'm not sure exactly how many countries, but a significant number of countries, including the US, but not the EU or the UK. So far, although it was signed by a lot of countries, only 4 countries have ratified it, and they are Singapore, of course, Fiji, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. But the fact that three countries have signed up to it means that there is a timetable now for it entering into force. And as I say, it will enter into force on the 12th of September of this year. The convention itself will be, I think, particularly interesting in relation to international disputes and international media and mediated settlements of international disputes, particularly if there's some issue about enforcing the settlement agreement and the question of assets located overseas. It is a bit unclear, I think, how far this convention is going to be used. But obviously, if it does develop a significance along the lines of the New York Convention, then it will become a part and parcel of considering international disputes and mediated settlements of those disputes. As I say, the US has signed up but not yet ratified, and the UK and the EU have not yet signed. So it remains to be seen what will happen over the next few years. And then the final point, and this is the COVID-19 point, in the same way as we've seen the English courts handling remote hearings and showing willingness to engage remotely with both hearings and trials, you know, can we have remote mediations and indeed not just during the pandemic? I see no reason why mediations that were already in process should not be continued with remotely. I do think that there are some aspects of the mediation process which are lost in a remote session. Clearly, one can have plenary sessions with multiple participants and multiple screens, and I don't see that that's such a problem. Where I think remote mediations, one would have to work much harder to get them to work effectively, is for those moments where it's appropriate just to put two parties together in a room, be it the key principal decision makers or indeed the two lawyers. How that works remotely remains to be seen.
We're back to the story about, you know, having lunch together. It's there is no substitute for a physical.
I think that's right, Dominic. I think it is the rapport that you can establish with somebody on the other side who may well have been a sworn enemy for many years. You know, suddenly in the mediation process, the dynamic of the process, you know, the two parties are put together in a room. They are the only people there or possibly there with the mediator. Of course, you could manage that even in the current environment with a socially distanced socially distancing in the room itself, perhaps. I mean, that's not ideal, obviously, but I think in a sense it may even be better than trying to do it via Zoom or WebEx or whatever. So that's an interesting one, but a plenary session I don't see such an issue with, I must admit. Again, the question of how you manage all the technology would be tricky, but frankly the English courts have shown that they can do it, and really most of the lawyers involved in it will be able to do it, and I think the clients would welcome that as well. I'm not aware of mediations taking place, at least for me it's more, I think, a question of, you know, can the mediation be delayed perhaps by a few months. And we are seeing, we were seeing with the pandemic, we're seeing some cases being put back for trial by a few months, if not significantly longer than that. And if that's the case, then the mediation can probably be put back as well. But there's no reason why it can't be dealt with remotely, subject to that rapport point I've mentioned.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Tim Wallace, who's sort of the head of an app called Trust Mediation, does a lot of clinical negligence mediation, tells me they've been doing a lot of mediations remotely, but I think using technology. And another mediator, Mark Field, who's written a good piece on LinkedIn, observing that the suggestion that you could do a mediation just by telephone is, I think, a non-starter, because you definitely want to have a look at your opponent's eyes, or, you know, there's going to be some degree of connection, and I don't think that could ever be achieved, nor does he, by telephone. Anyway, thank you everybody for joining us. I'm so grateful to Neil for sharing his wisdom, his expertise with us. This is, as ever, relevant for SRA accreditation. There is a quiz. It's not difficult. We leave that with you. Thank you so much for joining us, and hope you'll be back again. I think we've got cost reform on the horizon, but thank you. And thanks again to Neil. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.